Hello, world. You're listening to the Kitchener-Waterloo Linux User Group audio podcast. KWLUG discusses topics related to free and open source software of all kinds. We meet on the first non-holiday Monday of each month in Kitchener, Ontario, Canada. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share-alike license, so you can give it to others, remix it, or even sell it, provided you abide by the terms of the license and share alike the works that you remix and redistribute. For more information about KWLUG, visit kwlug.org. For more information about this podcast, visit kwlug.org/podcasts. In this month's presentation, Sandeep Jory describes his home network setup, and Mikolai Baruku introduces PrivacySafe and 3N Web, which allow you to run secure private servers in your own home. Once again, we had lots of problems with the audio, and our mic kept cutting out throughout the entire presentation. Sorry for the terrible audio quality this time.
Thank you very much. So I hope everyone can hear me. Should I speak louder? Is this good? Good. So again, this is about home networks, and very specifically about my home network and how I've set it up. My objective is, again, it's very beginner, like it's very basic as usual for those of you who attended my previous presentation a few months, maybe a year ago. But again, it's very specific how I've set up things. And what I'm hoping is that I'll get some feedback in terms of any questions or any doubts that you see or any holes that you see in what I've done that may cause the network to be not as secure as a home network should be. I don't want to overdo the security either, but at the same time, usable, but at the same time gives all the security that's needed. At the end of the day, most of my information is on a desktop or a laptop which is connected to the network. So I do want to make sure that people can't just simply get in and make away with my data. So this is roughly what my network looks like. So this here is my is the service provider, like router or cable modem that I have, and so this is where I basically connect to the internet. Again, what I've basically done is I'm using that, but again, I'm not using it as my true router at home. I do have my own personal router connected to this particular cable modem, if you like, and I've got two routers connected to it, and I'll explain why I landed up with the two routers that are currently connected to it. The other thing that I've done is that we had issues with, like, whole setup is in my basement, and we had issues with accessibility to Wi-Fi in the room upstairs, which is literally diagonally across from where the setup is in our basement. So I've tried different things, and what I landed up with was coming up with using power line adapters to use the home power line instead of pulling a network Ethernet cable through our house. And so I've used power line adapters, and to the power line adapter, I've got another router connected upstairs. And again, most of the routers, I think the main one that I have is the one that I've purchased. The other routers are all hand-me-down, kind of like scrap routers, if you like. And once I explain what I use them for, it'll hopefully give you a sense of whether that's good use or whether I could have done something differently. Again, just from a security standpoint, all the default passwords that came with the firmware that's on these routers, I have changed that. So it's not that we still have the default passwords embedded within the firmware that these routers work on. So I'll go on to the cable modem that, again, the service provider has provided me. Again, I have the DHCP is enabled, so it does have out IP addresses, and of course the location is in the basement. I have disabled Wi-Fi on this one, so this does not allow connections to Wi-Fi. I have enabled the firewall. Again, it's a like there are different things to the firewall, I've kept it very simple. Like, so the most basic setting of the firewall that came with the firmware that was available with this router. And again, all it does is it just blocks unsolicited incoming traffic. So again, it lets anything that's going out go, and of course, related responses come back. But anything that's unsolicited coming in from the internet, it blocks that. That's all that firewall does. And there are 4 Ethernet ports on this. And again, 2 of those I'm basically using to connect my 2 routers that I've got here, the personal router 1 and personal router 2. And the other 2 I've just connected, I've got these Magic Jack phones. I'm not sure if anyone heard of these, but they're very inexpensive. I've had them for years, and I've just connected them to the other 2 spots on the 4 Ethernet ports that I have. So very basic. Disable the Wi-Fi. DHCP server is enabled, so it does handle IP addresses. And again, 4 Ethernet ports, then that's how I've used them. So very basic in terms of the way I've done this. So one of the reasons and maybe I'll talk about it maybe when I get my second and my third router, is why I set it up this way, because you spend a fair bit of time configuring these routers to really work, to really work the way you want, like have them set up with the security, like basic security that I've got and how you want it to work, like the configuration, etc. So the good thing with having these routers is that if my service provider, if I change my service provider, or if the cable modem is way, or they've come up with an enhanced speed and I need to change my cable modem, I can do that in a flash without impacting any of the other security configuration that I have. Now, technically, you could back up your phone, upload it again on the new router, but still, that's one of the benefits that I see of having this setup, is that once you've spent the time in configuring your personal routers, like the service provider cable modem, like it has absolutely no consequence to whether you want to stay with your service provider, move to another one, or simply upgrade your upgrade the cable modem that they've provided. So I've gone to my personal router 2. I'm not sure why, but anyways, I'll go there. Like given that this is what it is. So what I use that for? So this is a really old WRT54G Linksys router, and it's got DDWRT running on it. Like, I'm not getting into too much about DDWRT, but again, got loaded onto this. And the reason I went in for a separate router for the work that it's doing is when my son was in high school, we actually made a gaming PC for him. And what we noticed was that once he started gaming and started reading slightly more advanced games, if we all were working off the same router, even though I tried to enable quality of service and all those other features, the router, I think, was the bottleneck, that it didn't have enough processing power to support the quality of service as well as allow all the other traffic to go through without impeding or coming in the way. And so we did try the quality of service route. Like, there was always buffering happening. If we were streaming Netflix and he was playing games, our Netflix would buffer, or he would really complain about the response times that he was getting. So again, really old, inconsequential router itself, but the fact that we were able to dedicate the gaming PC to that made all the difference. And he doesn't complain at all. So what I took away from that is that the bandwidth really wasn't the issue. It was just that the router's capability itself and the hardware and possibly the related software that goes with it. So that's why we went in for this independent separate router. The one thing that I did, because we didn't really need to network his gaming PC with all the other desktops and laptops that we have, that we gave it an independent, separate subnet. So it's not really part of our home network, so to speak. It's a totally different subnet. I'm assuming that helps ensure that there's segregation between machines connected to these networks and really cannot and hopefully don't talk to each other. But that was the whole idea behind having a totally independent, separate subnet for anything connected to this router 2 that I've given here. Again, I've got the gaming PC that I talked about. Again, Wi-Fi is enabled, and again, simple WPA encryption. And we use that for guests. So if anyone comes to our house and they ask us for their Wi-Fi password, that's the one we give them, and they basically get access to the internet. They can connect. We've got it set to a maximum of 10 users. We normally don't have more than 10 guests at home at a time. And that's how we've kind of ensured not that we suspect our guests or anything, but again, it's totally segregated from our own network. So they can log in like on their phone, or if they've bought a desktop, like especially if my son's friends from university come over, that's what they connect to, and they can continue to do their work unimpeded with at least having to set up or give them access through our main router. Again, the one thing I really liked about DDWRT, and that's why I went in with it, is that you can set it up to restart on a regular basis. So that's another thing I've noticed with at least the routers I have, is that if you don't restart them on a regular basis, they do start, like the quality of service goes down, like the connectivity, at times they drop connections or we have issues with that. So I've literally got it to restart automatically at 2:30 a.m. once a week. And I do check in once in a while, and there's never been an issue. It restarts on that particular point in time. And ever since we implemented this, and it's been several years this has been in place, and we've never had an issue where all of a sudden we can't connect and we have to kind of restart our whole network or anything of that sort. So that was a good feature that was available to me in DDWRT, in the Linksys out-of-the-box firmware, like that really wasn't an option that was available. Again, I've got a firewall on this one as well. And similar, like it's a SPI firewall and with very basic settings. It basically, again, does exactly the same thing. It just basically blocks anonymous WAN requests. So again, it's two firewalls. So I've got one firewall, obviously, that's here on the cable modem. And I've got another one. It might be overkill, might not be needed. But again, the option was there. I've set it up so that at least it blocks any kind of external threats that come in. Again, obviously, if someone's connected to this, then that's out the window. And again, I went through this why QoS wasn't a preferred option. So this is the piece that I talked about earlier, that with the gaming PC attached to this router, like it wasn't really working out with all the other connections that we had. So again, very basic, independent subnet, got some basic firewall going here. And again, it's connected via Ethernet to the cable modem. It's a really old Linksys PC, got DDWRT running on it. It is, it's got that DHCP server enabled to assign the IP addresses to people who are connecting. And again, it works fine. My son's happy with his gaming, so it must be doing its thing. I think from his perspective, he's more interested in the response times than the download and upload speeds. This is like one. If I test the download and upload speeds, this provides lower speeds than my main router. So obviously, some limitations, but for the purpose we are using it, it seems to be working fine. So I'll go to my main router. So this again is this is the one that I purchased, and I did purchase it to make sure that I would be able to install DDWRT on it. Again, OpenWRT I think is the open source version. You can install that as well. And again, this is the main the router that we have, that we've connected all our home laptops, my office laptops. I connect through this, the desktops that we have at home. Is basically connected through this router. And again, it is an independent subnet as well. Again, it's different from the subnet that's here. So again, it's a totally separate network that's created through this router. I've got all my home desktops, laptops, office laptops, and then Wi-Fi enabled. Again, WPA encryption, very straightforward. Again, same thing. I've got it reset to start at 2:30 a.m. once a week. Same SPI firewall that's enabled. The one thing that I've done with this, which is different from the router here, is when I set up the DHCP server, I set it to be enabled, I put the maximum DHCP servers down to zero. So and the way it's working is, and what I've done is, I have assigned IP addresses to all the MAC addresses of all the devices that we connect. So whether it be the phone, the tablet, like the laptops, the desktops, my office laptop, my wife's office laptop, like everything we've got, it listed out as like the IP address that is assigned by the laptop or by the router to that MAC address. And again, in some cases, especially for laptops, it could be a Wi-Fi MAC address or your Ethernet MAC address. So I've got both of those as well. So again, it turns out to be a fairly long list. But again, maybe like from a security standpoint, I just thought it's a really nice way of controlling who has access. So even if for whatever reason someone like cracks my Wi-Fi password, if they try and connect, and if they are not listed as like the MAC address is not listed along with the related IP address that the router is supposed to give out, it will not get any connectivity. So again, I think it works. Like, it seems to work, because whenever I try, like if like there's a new device that comes, you cannot connect. It seems as though you've connected. You type in the password and it shows that Wi-Fi connected, but you try and browse or anything else, nothing seems to work. I go onto the router, it doesn't really show that device as having been connected at all. And I do have to set it up with the IP address and the MAC address, and it's only then that device actually connects to the router and then onwards to the internet, or like it can connect to any of the network devices if they have the right credentials to do that. So that's my assumption, and I hope that assumption is correct, but that's in essence what I've done with regards to the again, I'm calling it the main router, because this is where like our all the devices at home are connected. Again, the other one is primarily the gaming computer, and like we basically the Wi-Fi that my guests use is basically the second router that we have here. So I'm assuming that all this makes sense, and it's secure because no one's speaking up. So I'm taking that as a good sign for what I've done so far. Yep, go for it, Paul.
Oh, well. So what happens if someone tries to set a static IP address that's on your network and then connect to the access point?
They will get access to the access point. That's, again, I'm hoping. So they would also need... So I do have WPA encryption, so they would need that password as well. So yes, so they would need the MAC address of an existing machine that I'm assuming is fairly easy to spoof or identify at least. So they would need that, plus they would need the password as well, like the WPA encryption, again the password that goes for connecting via Wi-Fi. It would be via Wi-Fi, right? Most of the cases, yeah, like Ethernet. Again, I'll talk about this whole power line adapter thing, because that got me paranoid a bit as well. Because the way I interpreted it is that if someone else comes with one of these power line adapters and hooks up to one of my wall sockets, like power sockets, then like they basically have connection to the internet. And I think like there's a reason why that's not true. But all the same, like that was the other thing that I was a bit paranoid about initially, is that I'm opening myself up to people being able to connect through this power line adapter setup that I've got going. But yeah, like the MAC address spoofing, like yeah, absolutely, that's a risk. Again, the only thing that I've got to fall back on is my assuming it's only through Wi-Fi that they connect to the router, and the fact that I've got WPA encryption enabled. I should be changing the password regularly. Again, that's I try and do it once in a while, but again, that is a risk that we run. like this whole dedicated IP address. I'm like, that's the way I try and control who has access. But to Paul's point, it can be spoofed.
So this isn't so much a question as something that somebody else introduced to me that rocked my world, which is how do you get guests onto your network? Well, you have to convey a 64-character randomly generated string to them, and it's really awkward to type that much punctuation. So there's a neat trick, which is you can have QR codes that encode your wireless network information. So if you go to my coat closet, please don't break into my house, but if you do, you're welcome to join my guest Wi-Fi. Open the coat closet, scan the code on the inside of the door, and you're online. So if you're, if you've got a lot of guests coming in, it's really nice.
It's a really nice feature, and you can I can set that up here.
Yeah, it's nothing on the device itself.
Device, exactly. It's the QR code translation to the password, basically.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So if you scan it with an iPhone, and I think Android phones as well, it fits a certain format. It has all your credentials kind of encoded in there. So in my case, all my guest network credentials encoded, and then it just you flash it, says, do you want to join network? Yes, and then you're done. So it's a great experience.
No, very true. So the thing that I've done, and I hope like I've not broken any or done the wrong thing, that the password that I've set is a human, like it's a phrase, for example, as opposed to a string of numbers, which I've seen when I go to my friends' houses at times. That's actually what you have to go through, and like is one better than the other, or at the end of the day, like it's the WPA and encryption that matters, not so much whether it's a string of numbers or a string of letters, right? Any thought on that, or
so yeah, so I guess I can answer that a little bit. It doesn't matter what WPA you except for like maybe WPA 3, but still that's been compromised. We actually, in class, we use a PlayStation Portable to crack all the WPA keys in this entire building. I don't know. Nathan, were you part of that? Do you remember that? No, you don't remember? Okay, that was afterwards. Any other students in here? Rats. The reason it's so easy is because you can just use hash tables to sequentially narrow down what's going through the air, right? So the weakness of WPA is not that it's a certain strength, like WPA2 with, 256-bit AES. It's the fact that you have it in the air for so long. So if you capture enough traffic, you can always find out what your password is. So the only solution to that would be using 802.1x, which is RADIUS, like RADIUS server. And the RADIUS server, once it authenticates you, it randomly generates a string that is not going to be in any hash table, right? Mm-hmm. Any rainbow table. So, and it passes it to the router, to the device, and says just for your one connection use this, and then it changes it every 1 minute, so it's impossible to hack, right? So that's kind of what so if you add a RADIUS server to it, which requires you have a RADIUS server on somewhere, then you can make WPA truly unhackable. But just with a pre-shared key, it's sitting out in the air, and anyone can get it with
secure.
A PlayStation Portable or a running Linux or this app on Android that's free download that I haven't tried, or my students have, right?
Yeah, no, that's very true. No, thanks for scaring me. No, but it's true. Like, that's one of the things that I had looked at, like WEP versus WPA. Like, I didn't really go into the RADIUS server component, but that's something I'll probably have to research. Maybe a presentation if I manage to set it up. Yep.
So my understanding for the WPA and the WPA2 and doing these like rainbow table or hash table attacks is that in addition to depending upon the password, it depends upon your SSID, like the name that you give your network. So one of the pieces of advice that I've read about online, I don't know how fast you can generate these tables now. So if you can generate them fast, it doesn't matter. But if it takes a long time to generate the table, is not to use the default SSID, not to use a common SSID, because those are kinds of tables that people have already generated.
Yep. So again, we do have a slightly separate like SSID for our network, But again, it's fairly basic. It's not overly complicated. So Radius server, that's my homework. I'll have to look into how best I can set that up.
It's certainly not as crazy setting up, what do you call it, a Radix server or Radius server? Radius server, but the way that I mitigated this at home is I have a setup similar to yours where there's a guest Wi-Fi and a home Wi-Fi. The home Wi-Fi only recognizes a certain MAC address. Where you've got your setup, and it has the big, long, 60-character nonsense string with all the punctuation in it, and then the guest Wi-Fi is set up at the router to only allow access to the internet, but not to allow access to any of the other devices on the network, and it has the simple little phrase that I can give to friends. So that way, when someone comes over and they want to use the Wi-Fi, they've got internet, but they can't hit the home server. It's obviously not as good as some of the other options, but it is one mitigation you might consider.
Right. So, like, what I take away from this is that the longer the length of your password, the more difficult it is to crack, like, the WPA encryption.
I think that's generally recognized to be true of all passwords.
Right. Perfect.
Generally speaking.
Perfect. No, that's good to know. No, and the longer the length, like, the software that you use, I presume it'll take longer and a larger number of packets to actually crack the password, I'm guessing. Perfect. That makes it easier than the Radius server.
Just to give you an idea how long it took a PlayStation Pro running UC Linux and Aircrack NG with a nice front end from some place in Germany that my students found on the dark web, it took us less than 5 minutes to crack 11 access points in this building, and some of the passwords were very, very long. So, and that's on a PlayStation Portable. The reason we use the PlayStation Portable because it's part of our ethical hacking course, and usually when you have to check your phone in at a building, you know, you can say, well, just a gaming console. Do you mind if I have this? It's a boring meeting. And they'll let you take your gaming console in, but they won't let you take your phone, right? So it doesn't take very long at all. And I know one of the students in the last teach, he found the equivalent tool installed on Android, and it was literally, I think, about 3.5 minutes to do the same 11 access points. And there was two that he could track. One was for corporate, the record. One was for not Stantec, that other place that's in this building. And the reason it couldn't crack, it said, on a code error, 802.1x, right? So you know there's a Radius server behind it, and it's downloading the certificate for the encrypted channel to negotiate these keys, right? So, it's very quick. It's very quick to crack a pre-share key. Pre-share keys are very insecure. They use a 24-bit initialization vector when they're algorithm, and so really, I mean, that's a good security design, but it was never meant to be. It was meant to be functional, right? But 802.1x was around since, I think, 802.11b, like we're talking almost 20 years ago, so they thought of that right when they came out with wireless security. So, you know, just as long as you add that extra massive overhead, you can make it secure. But it's massive overhead. You have to have the trusted root of the CA on every machine that connects. You have to have a certificate on your Radius server that gets downloaded at the beginning, but it's not much processing on the wireless access point. That's why home routers will always have that enterprise or 802.1x mode where you can point to a Radius server, even with, you know, like cheap routers. Right?
Well, thanks so much for that. Wow. So much. It's not that secure. I should take all my stuff offline. So I'll move on to power line adapter. So again, the whole concept behind this was that our, like, the cable modem and the main router at home was in our basement, and we had, like, literally no Wi-Fi signal in the room upstairs. So I tried different things. Like, I did try and, like, hook up a Wi-Fi signal booster in the middle so that the Wi-Fi signal would reach upstairs, and it did reach. But again, the performance or the speed that I was getting was very slow. Like, it was, like, I wouldn't even say maybe 1/20th of my, like, the normal router speeds that I would get in the basement. So that really wasn't working out for us. So I tried out these power line adapters. And for those of you who've not used these, it's very simple. You basically connect your Ethernet cable at one end, and you just attach it to the power outlet on the wall, it basically uses your copper wire to transmit the signals through your like the electrical wiring in your house. The few things that I noticed with this was that we're obviously a different circuit. Our basement is on a different circuit than the room upstairs. And if I tried to connect, like the takeaways that I had from everything that I tried, like the 20 different ways I tried to connect, is the one thing that I noticed was that the closer your power line adapter is to your to a power outlet, which is closest to your circuit board, that really gives you a better performance than if you're further away from the circuit board. So again, if you've got a room and if you're on one end and you connect your power line adapter there, and your circuit board is or your power like circuit board, I guess that's what it's known as, where you've got your switches and your fuse box. Fuse box is what I'm looking for. Thanks. So the fuse box is at the other end. Like the longer the length that it has to travel through the copper wire, like it loses its signal strength. So that was one thing, is that the closer you are to your fuse box, like the better, like I've noticed, is the output that I get. Sorry. Yeah. The question. And again, it's probably, so we've got, like, my guess is we've just got, like, our basement is, like, may not be the right thing, but I think it's one circuit or one fuse, and I've not noticed any drop in the speed. The one thing I've noticed is that if I use the same power outlet, I not only have a power line adapter attached to it, but even a simple thing like a lamp, that actually degrades the output that I get or the speeds that I'm getting. So the one thing that I've done is I dedicate that power outlet just to the power line adapter. And the other aspect is I try and keep it as close to the fuse box as I possibly can. And that somehow has given me a good throughput in terms of the performance that I'm getting.
Bit of experience with these two. It's not so much heavy load will affect them, but a noisy load will. Yep. So if you plug in something with a very simple brushless motor or a DC brush motor, like a vacuum cleaner or something, the noise that is generated on your AC in that area would affect performance. I have also been told that they are literally just a Wi-Fi device that uses your power as the antenna. I haven't been able to confirm that, but somebody did tell me that that's basically what it is. But yeah, in terms of load on your circuit, it also struggles to get through surge protectors as well. So you should plug it directly into the wall and not through a surge protector. It does work, but apparently it does limit its functionality if you do it that way.
No, absolutely. And again, I tried it that way once. Is through the surge protector, and again, I was literally getting no signal at the other end. So again, it's simple things like this. Keeping it as close to the circuit box as you can, and just having that one power line adapter connected to the power outlet, those, like, at least for me, has worked. So.
And don't vacuum your house ever.
but the other thing is, and I think it basically boils down to the circuit on which, let's say, your vacuum cleaner or your microwave or your washing machine is. Maybe, like, we just lucked out that the basement is on a totally different circuit and our room upstairs where we need it is on a totally different circuit. And I'm assuming, like, the way they are, like, the way it hooks through the circuit box, we've never had an issue. We can be using the microwave, like, the dishwasher's running, the vacuum cleaner's running, not impacted our, like, performance. That said, so I've got three power line adapters that are connected, and the one thing, again, it needs to be paired. So that was my thing that I was concerned about, that anyone can come in with a power line adapter, hook it to a power outlet home, or even if it's outside, and get access to the network. They do need to be paired. So there is, I'm assuming, that security that enables or ensures that not anyone can connect a power line adapter to your to a power outlet and get access to your network. So that was at least that's the only security that I have for the power line adapter. But I've got three of these connected. So one is obviously in the basement, which basically takes in the Ethernet connection from my main router. The second one is on our main floor where we have a family room. So we've got a television. It's one of those older cabinets that you have above the fireplace, which kind of project out, and it's got a metal casing. So if, with the television in front, there's no Wi-Fi signal that penetrates through if you have a PC or anything sitting at the back, which we do. So I've got a power line adapter set up there. So to when I compare, let's say, download and upload speeds, I haven't seen any degradation, like irrespective of whether I'm on the main floor or on the floor upstairs. Download speeds compared to what I get in the basement if I'm connected directly to the router. If I'm on the main floor, it drops by about 40%. And if I go to the floor above, like our first floor, it drops by about 70%. So it's only 30% of the speed that I get. But what I've noticed, and this is in our room upstairs where we don't even get Wi-Fi signal, but it's much, much better than if I tried to put in the Wi-Fi like extender, like the range extender kind of tool, and this works much better for me, like in terms of having this power line adapter set up. So I've got three. One is in the basement, that's basically hooking it up to the router. One is on in our family room, which is basically behind the television. We've got a desktop there, which makes our TV smart, so to speak. So again, we use that, and of course we've got one in our room upstairs where otherwise we have had no signal at all. So that's how we are using the power line adapter, and it's worked flawlessly. Like there's occasionally once in several months I might need to unplug it and like just let it be unplugged a bit and plug it back in, but it's very rare that that's happened, and it's really worked very effectively for us in terms of at least giving us throughout the house. And again, these routers that I have connected to it are fairly basic, like old routers, so even the Wi-Fi signal strength is fairly weak. So within the rooms, you probably get good enough Wi-Fi signal, but if you go outside or if you're downstairs, for example, in our driveway, you hardly get any signal because these routers are so bad, which in a way is a good thing, that their signal doesn't really travel that far. Where it travels, it's good enough, and it gives us a fairly good connection speed. So again, that's the whole reason why we kind of gravitated towards the power line adapters. And at least I haven't noticed anything. It's maybe just by the luck of the draw and the way our circuits work that don't get any disturbance from any of the appliances we have in the kitchen or the laundry or the vacuum for that matter. It does not impact it at all. And again, like there are times when like I'm vacuuming and if someone's connected, they definitely complain. There's been like no issues so far. So that's with regards to the power line adapter. Then I'll go to the last router that we have, which is, again, what I've done is in the room upstairs, I've actually connected a router to that particular power line adapter there. The one thing that I've done is I have disabled DHCP. So it doesn't really, it's not serving as a DHCP server. It's literally just serving as a switch. So I've got basically four Ethernet ports. And again, the one thing that I learned the hard way is if you want to use your router as a switch, you actually have to do not use the WAN connection to connect your connector. If you like, you should use one of the four Ethernet ports and use the remaining three for connecting to your other devices. So that worked well, and the benefit is it's even got the Wi-Fi functionality. So I've got the Wi-Fi signal going from there. The one thing I did, and I don't know whether I did the right thing or not, but I'm using the same SSID as my main router's SSID. I'm not sure why I chose it that way. I thought it would be a smart thing that it would transition from one router to the other, like when I'm moving, like if I'm carrying my laptop up or my phone, and it'll automatically switch, and it's the same SSID. But the same thing would happen if it was a different SSID, if as long as I would have authenticated against it, like in the past, it'll remember that connection, and it'll switch. The other thing that I felt that if I had a separate SSID on the router upstairs, I would know which router I'm connected with. Otherwise, I'm basically guessing based on signal strength that, oh, I'm most likely connected to this router or I'm connected to the router in the basement. But regardless, like, it's really served us well. On this router, like, again, we've tried to concentrate all our, like, our music, the home movies we have, like, everything on our desktop. So that's why we've got literally lots of desktops around the house. And again, so this has a desktop connected to it as well. Again, we stream Netflix on it. Like, we don't have any issues with regards to the throughput and the download and upload speeds that we are getting. Like, Netflix works, YouTube works, Spotify, like, that works as well. Of course, that requires less bandwidth, but all these things work without a problem using that, again, hand-me-down router that we've basically connected, not a DHCP server, connected via the power line adapters to our main router in our basement. And again, the throughput or the download speeds that we get are about 60% less than what we get at the router downstairs. But it's much, much better than if we try to use Wi-Fi instead. Again, this is a D-Link router. Again, I have no idea where I got it from. It's basically the out-of-the-box firmware. Again, I've got firewall enabled there, like, whatever that's worth. Like, again, I do have logging enabled, and the logs show me nothing. So, like, I'm assuming that this router is probably what's blocking all the traffic. And after that, like, it's pretty obvious that the other routers literally won't need to block anything, because the cable modem that we have is basically blocking any unsolicited incoming requests. Again, that's basically at a high level how I've set up my home network. Again, like, I've tried to just put it from a security perspective. Like, this is paired. We've got Wi-Fi, like disabled on our service provider modem. We just have a basic firewall enabled here. Like, on the main router, we've got a different subnet, basic firewall, MAC address reservation, WPA encryption. And I think that's my takeaway, is that I'll have to see what better alternatives exist. Again, I do change my password often enough, and hopefully there aren't too many people in our neighborhood who are trying to crack into my password. But then, to Paul's point, like, my MAC addresses can be easily identified and spoofed, and if someone cracks open my Wi-Fi password, then, like, they basically have access to our network. So that's something, like, the Radius server is something I'll have look into. Again, we've got the second router, which basically has a different subnet. Again, it's for the gaming PC. And through the power line adapter, we have the router upstairs. Again, maybe overkill, but got the firewall working there as well. It's basically serving as a switch. It like the DHCP server is basically our server downstairs. And we've got WPA encryption enabled. So I think my take at least is that, like, I better look into that Radius thing. Again, not that I'm hoping, like, even my desktops have, like, the UFW, like, the basic firewall that comes with Linux. I've got that enabled, and we do have SSL. Like, that's the only way people can connect, and they do need to know the user ID and password. So I'm hoping that even if someone manages to crack through our routers, we've got some security built into our devices that are connected that would at least act as another like wall that person has to jump over. But that was it from my perspective. Like, I'd really, really appreciate if anyone has any other comments or suggestions on things that I should do slightly differently. Yes, please. Exactly. Okay. Right. But see, like, from that perspective, like, firewall won't really help me with that, will it? Or can I I presume I could set up a firewall to restrict outgoing packets to be from specific IP addresses or specific MAC addresses?
I think it may not help because I am going to spoof the IPs.
Exactly.
And I'm struggling with this myself in the server room.
Right, exactly.
The not radio even server at home might be without the best way any to go. Wi-Fi.
Yeah, no, exactly. And the radio server, because again, I tried to think this one through as much as I could. And after a point, I said, you know what, like, if someone's that determined with the tools that I have, that this is, I felt the best I could do, like the radio server is something I'll definitely look to. And see how easy is it to set up. I do have, and again, that whole sync thing that I talked about. So I do have this old laptop, which the monitor doesn't work. So I'm just using it as a standalone, and I've got my JBOD linked to it. So I could use that technically as a radio server if that's all the bandwidth that it needs.
Do you have a printer?
I do have a printer, yes. So they can
don't put too much paper into it, because some pranks are actually printing too much stuff.
Absolutely. I'm hoping the MAC address will help, but to whatever extent it does. Yes, Paul?
So I guess one of the questions that people always ask when it comes to security are, what are you trying to protect? Like, what's sort of your model of what are you afraid of will happen?
So, what we've done is we've digitized more or less everything that we have. So our music collection, our home video collection. What I also do is I also, and maybe that's something I'll have to relook at how I've secured it, but all our documents, like our passports, like I scan them and I store them on my desktops. So again, that information does reside on my desktops. Again, it's personal information, so it's nothing shattering, if you like, especially for inconsequential individual. But again, it's my personal information, basically, that I'm trying to make sure is secure to the extent it needs to be. Yep. Either one. Like, CryptoLocker would be another thing. Now, again, like, I'm assuming with Linux, the basic security I've got there, the CryptoLocker may not work. I could be wrong on that. But, again, yes. So it's both. Like, I do need access to that information. Again, got through sync thing. I've got backups all over the place. But, again, that would be, it would be both issues. Like, they take my information or they lock me out of it. Yep.
So I'm a bit orthodox. I know because my grandma was an orthodox Jew. But, that terrible joke. But, I define the word security as kind of a similar to the word control, as in, a secure system is a system that allows you to do what you want to do with the system and exclude what you don't want to do it. So a secured server would be a server that is available for your customers but not to the hackers. So if the hacker knocks it down, it's an insecure system. If your customers can't get to it, you don't have security. And so to that end, I looked at the network, and I've made similar decisions at home, and there's no perfect solution, so no criticisms here. And one of the design goals of my network was to say, my wife is a little smarter than your average historian. She's a professor of history, and I think she'd do great in IT, but she doesn't know this networking stuff. And sometimes I don't want to be home. So my network is designed under the ideas of things like, she can Google for it. She can look at the cables. There's only two or three of them. And she can pick, I think this one will do it, you know. And I've designed it with the understanding it can be sophisticated, but can also be relatively accessible to somebody who has a modest amount of experience with that equipment. So My question to you really is kind of, what are your thoughts there? How do you think about the rest of your family being able to kind of operate, you know, when you're not home or when, you know, for whatever reasons, right? When you're not available.
Absolutely. So again, I'd probably put myself in the same bucket as your wife. I'm not that technically savvy either. And so that's one of the things that I did want to keep in mind is I want to keep it simple enough that like everyone at home, me included, don't stumble over like or lock ourselves out from not being able to get access to the internet or anything of that sort. So we did try and keep it simple so that if something and so far, like when if worst case scenario, if something's gone wrong, it's just a boot that's needed at the router level, and that seems to set things right. Then again, even that I've got set up going that it reboots every like once a week. So knock on wood, like we've not had any issues, but that is one of the goals, is that it's not only like it could even be like my mother lives with us and she has a tablet and she kind of speaks with her relatives and friends all over the place on Skype, and at times like if things don't work for her, she would be extent handicapped and she has no idea, like she keeps calling these routers, these things which have those blinking lights, and why is it like her biggest issue is why is it should be straight and things like that. But absolutely, like simplicity was very key in what I wanted to set up, but at the same time secure enough that as you said, like it's basically people that like we use it for the purpose that we want to and not beyond that, and we keep control over how it's used. But yeah, simplicity was paramount from our perspective. Yep. I think I've run out of time. Thank you so much. No, that was it. And I'll definitely look into that Radius server.
Yeah, okay. So my name is Mikolai, and I'm working on this project called 3N1. Basically, I presented this at Libre Planet. Second year, we were doing the presentation as a vendor there. And the guy over there shows up, Sean Bryan, and he says, hey, we want to make the hardware. So the hardware looks like that box. Basically, it's based on this little board. It's called BeagleBoard. Like there's a company, Aero Electronics, that is doing this BeagleBoard.org, like different components. And this is the revision 81. So you can look the scale, but tucks approximately the same. And the scale with your 2.5. Hard drive SSDs. So guys, just pass it around so you can see and touch it. So the hardware for the home server is like, you know, your next generation future hardware that you're gonna have at home. It looks something like, you see this main board at the top, and at the bottom there's just like some USBs, and below you can put an extra hard drive and not much else. Basically, your home server doesn't have to be smarter than your phone. We'll get to that in a little later. So this thing is called the privacy safe. The idea is that you completely own your life. You completely own your data. And besides that, you also own your server. The 3NWAP server, which is run by this little guy, allows you to actually not care whether the data is present, like where the server is. But some people want to actually have a hardware. And there are also installations where your whole setup is separated from the rest of the world. So these devices will definitely go into those installations as well. They cannot use the cloud provider for the 3NWAP server, which helps user keep their data not in the hands of somebody else, but be totally in control of it. So the project is all open source, both the hardware and the software. The stack is like, it's a Debian GNU Linux, it uses BeagleBoard, which is open hardware. The FreedomBone, it's like a Freedom Box, but it's for the BeagleBone, is done. Here it's us, 3NWAP, giving you storage, messaging, and the platform for other apps that are done in such a way that you can use a small server to run it. You can have it at home. And then there are other things like Tor project. Some of the things that we'll discuss later on may use Tor, and that's what will be done. Then there's something like GNU Health, BTC Pay. So the partners doing, like the Privacy Safe guys, they have a little thing over there going with them. So Indiegogo campaign started today at 4:30. The link was known. So, yeah. Do go buy it or tell somebody to buy it. Now, the client side for the 3NWAP thing comes from our website. It's a 3NWAP. 3NWAP.global or .com. And technically, yeah, this is our part of the thing. So let's talk about what do we mean by owning stuff and what ownership gives you. Now, you had fun in the car which you had yourself. It was your car, you could do anything in that, right? You own your house, or the law allows you to actually sort of be as owner in the house that you rent out, that you are renting. And that is part of our life. We don't even notice it as much. You start to notice that the lack of ownership is very limiting and degrading in those countries where you have problems with ownership, like, you know, post-Soviet Union, maybe in China, maybe in North Korea. And those things are missing a fundamental thing, respect for ownership. But in a digital world, we don't own ours in our current situation. And the reason we have the privacy problem is not because we have something which is very interesting. No, the reason is don't own the Facebook. We can only beg for privacy over there, or we can only ask Google, but they may not grant us the permission. So basically, ownership is the important thing. The security and the privacy comes in the place which you own, which you control. Ownership is a total control of something to the exclusion of all other people in the universe. That's the definition. Now, with the physical world, we understand that here's an object. I hold it in your hand, nobody else has it. So the ownership is simple. In a digital world, our signals always create copies of the data. So basically, you thought of something, well, one copy is in your head. But once it goes into the computer, there is another copy. In fact, there will be many copies at every stage. Like there's a cache in the computer. There's a lower cache in the processor. There's a SSD cache on the server. There will be a hard drive on the server. There will be tons of copies. And what do we mean by ownership? If there's many copies of the object. So basically, if somebody hacks your data center, what the hacker say? We own them because they copied the data. You still have data, but they copied the data. So when servers, cloud providers get the copy of the data, that is a de facto loss of ownership. By the terms and conditions, it's just put into legal framework. That's it. So what do we do about it? We want ownership online. So the solution is simple. Can we not give the copies to the servers, to the providers? And the 3N web is basically an attempt to do just that. How do we have a client-server architecture? Because it's actually the most effective way of doing the communications. Peer-to-peer networks are cool, but they suffer from slow connections, not very simple things happening on. In fact, our partners on the Privacy Safe, when they were going and trying to get the software for their little home hardware, people were saying, like, there's a stack where you sort of, all people share their files. So you keep somebody's files. Even if they're encrypted, people were not easy about that. Human nature. The server, it's simple. Server provides me a service, I pay it a little bit. It's like, well, I wake up in the morning, I go to Tim Hortons, I get the coffee from them, I pay them a little bit. Very fair thing. Same thing with the bread. We do it every day. Unfortunately, with Google's, we have, like, you know, everything is sort of expected to be free, but then it turns out that we are sort of abused. Our data is abused. So with the 3N web, the idea is that, basically, before it was called the 3N web, the idea was how do we get a simple utility in which I may have business, and as true business as simple bakery, because bakery is a very good, honest business, lots of competition, very nice, we live with that. And the mantra that we came with is this 3N mantra. So when we never send any plain text to the server, that is called an end-to-end encryption. Everybody has it. Signal, some matrix, basically how it works. PGP, PGP keys is the first example of end-to-end encryption. I'm sending you email, only you can open it. If there's a server in between, they don't have a keys to open the ciphertext. So no plain text to the server. It protects against wiretapping by the server. Repeat after me. The signal, the wire, the spider hook, they all protect against wiretapping when they use end-to-end encryption. Surveillance, on the other hand, is knowing who you talk to, is knowing who you send the data to, and that is a behavioral data. We know from the court's documents that Signal, for example, doesn't collect this behavioral data, but they can. The protocols between the client and server are set up so that the server can collect this information, who connect to me and who I'm sending the messages to. They just happen not to do that. Some of the providers, like I think SpiderOak and others, they put their headquarters and jurisdictions in Switzerland in order to be sort of immune to all of those requests to please start collect data on our users. But is this a game we want to keep on the political side? Maybe we can have a technical solution. So that's where, yes. Yes. So the question is about encryption and the traffic and how the traffic goes. So basically all of the protocols, A, they use encryption. It's actually using HTTPS. And inside of that HTTPS, the packets, the objects that are sent are end-to-end encrypted. So basically there's sort of two layers of encryption. Do we use the public key infrastructure? Yes, for HTTPS, we use public key infrastructure. It already exists and it's good enough for this end-to-end talking sort of on one layer of this OSI stack. So the question is like whether we are vulnerable for compromise of PKI security certificates. Most of our protocols, we'll go into them later, they are done in such a way, even the most important one is the mailer ID for identity, is where if there's a compromise on the certificate for the TLS and if there's somebody on in the middleman attack, then the only worst thing that happened is that if your password, if your keys are derived from your password, then the attack on your password becomes can be done as an offline attack, like going through the hash tables. It's a usual attack when the hashes of the passwords are dumped and we try to go through them. And that's the only thing that is possible. So basically, it's just a decrease in security. It's not a total compromise if the TLS certificates in our setups are forced, or like, you know, government comes to our server and say, hey, use this certificate. If the government comes to me, come on. You know, they will give me an offer I cannot refuse, you know. I know that. Not for everything. In fact, for the communication between humans, no. We'll go a little later into the messaging and the keys, especially the keys. Yep. Step by step. So when we give nothing to the servers, no copies, then we get an ownership. Ownership means that the only person who owns stuff is the person who has the copy, and that's me or the user. So that's the 3N web concept. And we know the 3N web worked everywhere. All NSA-like agencies do the segregation of duties and stuff like that. So let's look at the messaging. Oops. At the messaging. In fact, the story goes like this. In 2013... I've heard about the service called Mega. You know, there were Mega uploads, and then they were shut down, and then the guy created Mega, which was end-to-end encryption storage. I was like, wow, I want to have such business myself. I want to provide this service. It's good, because you sort of own. So basically, the gist is that it's easier for the storage. For the messaging, the story is a little bit more complex. You have to pass things around. Historically, that's the messaging how it was done. It's a postal service. Now, you recognize that this is an SMTP email, but nothing changed from the post. We still have entities in between that have to cooperate, that have to know how the mail goes. So this is a picture not only of email, it's also a picture of XMPP. It's a picture of all classically federated networks, like Matrix. That's what it is. Now, when people asked, how do you think your mail gets from you to your friend? They never talk about this. They have no idea that this exists. Not at all. People think that this is how stuff works. So we actually made the 3D web to work this way. The reasons are a little bit going down further, but one of the reasons is that it's awesome. It's simpler. It's much simpler. In this picture, the first MSA or MTA will tell you that you cannot send more than 25 megabytes in your attachment. Your toast. In this picture, only the user of inbox can say, dear server, don't accept more than 10 gigabytes from this set of senders. And all those unknown guys, they allowed to leave me like 50 kilobytes. So, now this simplicity also can be secured properly way. So if the connection that is done in our application protocols lie on top of HTTP, so it's on application level of OSI model of protocols, and IP level, logging of IPs can be protected by the Tor because it's a little bit lower. Now, coming back to the classical federation. You remember the story about Alice and Bob. So, cryptographers have been helping Alice and Bob for quite a few days. They're good. Everything is settled for Alice and Bob. But the problem exists for Juliet and Romeo because their servers on their federated network don't cooperate. First of all. And when Juliet sends anything end-to-end encrypted to Romeo keys, connecting with the Tor network to her server, that server has to know where the message will go. That's why on a Congress House, they have XMPP network, and all the security guys are always saying, oh yeah, those servers are a very juicy target because you know who's talking to who. So, you see, this is what I call a classical federation. All services are usually, when we say federation, is this. And the problem with, you can say Capulet and Montague, but Google and the rest of the world in 2008 when they stopped cooperating with the XMPP world, that happened because Hangout was on XMPP originally. Maybe a year ago or maybe just half a year ago, Slack shut off XMPP. So this stopping users or breaking federation for users by the servers is what happens plus classical federation. We don't want that. That limits my user's freedom. Freedom to talk with somebody else. So there is this web style federation. You use it every day. You open browser tabs. One tab is New York Times, another tab is Washington Post or some Chinese newspaper. You already get a federated experience without those servers actively cooperating. So that's why this type of connectivity I call a web style federation. So basically that what is in the 3N web, and that's the reason why the web part is also in there. Yes. Question. So the question is, do we assume that Tor is bulletproof? No, we don't assume that. And the Tor I put there is if the user decides to hide their IPs from the server of the recipient, they may choose any technology. It can be Tor, it can be IP2, I believe. It can be just a VPN. It can be a VPN that you trust. It can be China firewall. It depends on what you decide as a client. So in protocols, for the 3N web protocols, we have a situation where client has more leverage. Those decisions on how I talk to the server belongs to the client. So for example, right now we have an implementation that goes just over IP without the Tor. For the privacy safe, within this year before the devices will be sent, we will create that add Tor to the client. That is the part of the plan. So that, yes, the client will be able to talk over Tor, but the client is also open source, and you can use any client. It's the choice of a client what software they run. It's not the choice of the server. The server only has to obey the 3N web protocols. That's all.
But, so the most secure implementation will be with Tor, but Tor is not bulletproof, yeah?
Yes, that's true. The Tor is not bulletproof. Nothing is probably is bulletproof except for the encryption. And encryption that is secret key encryption, AES or SALSA, something like that. Now, with our protocols, like in messaging, the server has no say in what sort of encryption you use. So once DGB produces his post-quantum library for the public key in cryptography, a user may decide, I'm switching to that. As long as the recipient can read those bytes, it will be fine. And the server, again, has no say in that. The server cannot degrade your security because it wishes to do so. So 3N web, I said, is a set of supported 3N web respecting protocols. One of the protocol called MailerID, it's non-tracking identity protocol. It's actually important to have. There's a first contact problem that exists in messaging. It means like there's, say, Alice and Bob, but they're like maybe one is Chinese, another is Japanese. They never met each other. They never shared the key physically. And that's the first contact problem. And the MailerID helps that. At the same time, it's useful for other things. The authenticated secure mail, SMail, is for messaging, and 3N storage is like, you know, simple storage protocol. End-to-end encrypted, of course. So the 3N web thing looks like this. There's a user. It talks to the server, which serves the 3N web services. Now, the overall view is when we zoom into the client. Come on. Oh, sorry. It detached on this side. Oops. No, it's a physical thing. Never jump to assume malice to where the simple, So the client side is basically a core and application. And that's what we'll talk right now. So let us go to the demo. So the that's my browser. So you go to the 3N web, you click download. There's a downloading of the client. There will be clients for Windows, Mac OS, and the mobile sooner or later. So we have already installed the client. It will be also available for a download in the form, which you can just put in onto the flash drive and use it only on the flash without leaving any traces on the computer. Oops, now that's capital letters. Set. Yeah, so the program is called 3N Web, and I just want to start the daemon. That's why there's set SID in there. Most important is that data directory. So I choose a particular data directory. It doesn't exist at the moment on my desktop. So it's right here. And yeah, let's do it. Okay, it's opened on another screen right here. This is presented. I know that there's like, let's imagine I'm Bob Marley. I already went through this registration process. So it's a Bob Marley at 3nweb.com. Notice that there are spaces, and the spaces are for humans, but the actual email or ID doesn't have those spaces. Basically, it's a canonical form that is used by servers, and the human form with the spaces is used for humans to see. But checks that are done by the client and servers, they go into the canonical form. Yes, Paul? Yes, thank you. 3N web. Otherwise, it would not work. It will give off the error, and we don't know how robust the beta version for the errors yet. So this implementation takes the key and does the script from which it derives the master keys for... Come on. All right, this way. Master keys to open the files. Basically, right now you're seeing a UI application, basically a 3N web application that runs on top of the 3N web core, a platform. So developer of this application never even thought about the keys. All they know is that they are given an API, like in a browser, because it's an Electron application, that they want to send something somewhere else. And they also have an API for the file system. Application says, I want a synchronized file system for me, please. And the core is like, oh, this particular application has the name, wants that. Is manifest allows it. And so the Electron version is very bolted down. And for example, this thing, although it's web technology, it has a XMHTTP request object. When it does the request, it will get out. Like for the sake of the time, so basically, you know, usual stuff. New mail, let's send Sean or Brian. Come on. Here it is. Yeah. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. So basically, it's sendo. Sometimes there are errors on the network. Yeah. Now, coming back to this desktop, where we said there will be a folder with the data. That's the folder. This length is actually base64 for the user. It's not encryption. some stuff still has to be open, but everything else is like objects. Objects have random names, random IDs. The only thing that exists is that they have versions. So this particular object is right now at version 2. This one is at version 3. This is a root object. The only object that has like recognizable name, root. There's a file system in which every file has a key, its own unique key, and it's sort of like a tree going down. And all of this in this flat form, so that the server cannot recognize what's in the user's files. So that's the way to hide the, or not to give server the data. So the file can be split into many objects. Yes?
Back to the root of all this?
Sorry?
Can you go back to the root of all this?
Back?
The directory structure there. You had... Keep going, one more.
One more. There's an inbox in the storage. And the inbox is actually also a cache with some of these messages. And messages are just the names.
So all of your mail data was in there to begin with?
No. Actually, it was pulled from the server.
Okay, so it was on the server.
Yes, this is server. In fact, what you see here is exactly what is on server. What I'm saying is that you cannot crack it and you cannot get out much information from this. And instead of just blindly believing the statements on the website that we make, that there's no metadata, you can actually look at this and say, can I see a pattern here?
There are two copies of the data.
Sorry?
There are two copies of the data.
You mean like there's on the server and cache on the client? Yes. And that improves the performance. This is a great part. Like, your smartphone with 3N Web will actually be doing stuff for you instead of just running the advertisement to somebody else. Yep. How do we pay for? So right now we are starting sort of like a beta version, but then it will be like a regular payment, or maybe we'll find other ways for Bitcoin, whatever. But it will be a simple payment for, like, this is like us provider. Anybody else can become provider. That little device is the provider for the 3N Web server, right? The name origin, so the way you find where to talk, like the way your client server finds where to talk, is like on the web. What your web browser does, it says, somebody something at this domain. Okay, what is that domain? There's this DNS resolution that happens. Since it's an SI stack level DNS, this protocol can be actually placed on some other form of naming. But not right now, we're doing it for DNS because it's most commonly will be used anyway. And so one server for one domain, we are for another. We'll be serving things like 3nweb.com, 3nweb.ch, 3nweb.de, stuff like that. And we'll have the domains which you, yes. So, the question is fundamentally an end-to-end encryption object store. Yes, and all the protocols are set out such a way that the client doesn't provide unnecessary information to the server, so that the server cannot compile that behavioral data. So, yes, all of those guys, Signal, all of those Spider Oaks, I want them to use that protocol. Yes, that will open a competition because actually Signal is the island. They don't have somebody else federating. Spider Oak is an island. You cannot share your file with somebody from the competitor to the Spider Oak, their headquarters in Switzerland. This is open. The server, so the server in the Web Federation, when there's direct connection from the client to the server doesn't have to know identity of who connects. So if you don't know that that who comes from a competing domain, you cannot break the federated experience for your users necessarily. So basically, yeah.
Can you send me an email?
Can I send you? Yes, of course. In fact, I'll post something on the list. Oh, sorry?
Can you send me an email to my Gmail account from this
Oh, can I send you a Gmail account? Of course not. For the same reason, you cannot connect non-leaky pipe to a leaky pipe and assume it's non-leaking. Yes, we have to transition. That's why these protocols are going to RFC process so that they become standard. Documented standard that people can implement. So the website, our GitHub, we have a bunch of things. One of them is called a spec server. Basically, you call yourself a 3N web if you pass integration tests which are in this spec server folder. And this is a spec server that basically this will go into the little privacy safe server. Maybe if they will get enough money, we'll make it not a Node.js server, but we'll do a Rust version to make it more efficient because it doesn't have a processor. So let's come back to the... A little demo I did. So you see, basically, any applications can be done. But we have to talk about the computational model here. So currently, what we have is the servers that do the important computation on their side. As a result, they need that data. So the server is, in a way, in charge. With the 3N web, the computation happens on the client side. And that allows for not passing important stuff to the server. At the same time, the server can be a simple board, like I showed you, which is smaller than the hard drive on which the data in encrypted form will reside. Questions? Okay, so this is the one of the major points, actually. Can you put your application into from this form into that form? And some of the question can be like, okay, I have, for example, my contacts application opened. I'm running out of time. And it might be open on two devices simultaneously. So it means that the application will have to watch whether the files are changed on another side. And the file system API provides that thing. Yeah. So there's the core that does everything, the communication, the keys, everything is in that core. Since everything is run on top of the core, on your handheld device, for example, or on your desktop, that core knows what sort of applications you run, what sort of 3N web applications you start. But the server does not. And so we see that even in the Western world, sometimes people think that people have to be policed on what they compute. But it shouldn't be that way. We shouldn't turn the nice free liberty field place into something that reminds me of the country which I left. In fact, I do this project because there is nowhere else to go. So, 3NWebs, they have, they are like webs right now, but there's a chance that we'll also make a core so that there's an API for like Java apps, not the Java, but on Android, and maybe like something more universal. We'll see. Most important thing is that we have a core which acts like a policeman and that acts on behalf of the user. That's what the browser is doing. You know, the browser has this, it's the first program that actually takes the user, and the user is the most important, goals that the browser should protect. And then there are goals of the processors that are websites, or, for example, in this case, 3NWeb, other programs. So we leverage that technology in the 3NWeb. So the current application is done via Electron, and basically Electron has this main process. You can tighten it up. There's some other form of Electron which was supposed to be tightened security. Now the Electron is doing it better than they used to do, and that still can improve. Implementations can be different. What matters is the 3NWeb protocols. So as long as client talk to the server, do not give out unnecessary information and pass only end-to-end encryption stuff, you own your digital life. Now the code is on things. There will be RFC and a little note that, okay, we'll flip it for this code. And a little note is that you enjoy on Linux a lot of applications that were written by somebody. Now, the question is, why don't you have the free and non-tracking applications like that on the web? And the answer is actually economics. If I want to create an application for you that you can use on many different devices, I have to actually pay for some server in some cloud. With the 3NWeb, the user pays for utility on the 3NWeb. And the application that is run, user just, sort of installs it in its own 3NWeb thing, platform. Server doesn't know about it, So there is a possibility for this flourishing that we have in Linux on the desktops, flourishing like that to happen on a web applications, where applications are network aware and run on many devices simultaneously. That sort of, that's the future. That's the goal. Yeah, and sometimes, you hear about it, there's this question, what's your threat model? We talk about security, we say, what's your threat model? Well, here's an easy question. What is your data ownership model? My wife is sort of like, yes, we're same. She's like, oh, my data ownership is simple. It's all on one hard drive. She doesn't use the cloud, but she uses only one device. In fact, I've been using only one device because I never had an option of something, and now we're making it. We're switching sort of our own each this way. And with the 3NWeb, I'll be able to actually use different devices like a mobile and a desktop. Sorry, my time is out. Questions? Yes. How do we prevent a bad guys from profiting from the privacy? How bad guys have been prevented from profiting of the liberties that were given in this Western world in comparison to Russia? Same way. The similarities are there. not all people are bad. There's more good uses for this thing. And if you want, basically right now, we are being sold on the idea that surveillance is the only way to find the bad guys. Well, automated surveillance, mass surveillance, which is very cheap per capita, which allows police chefs to just fire detectives, not to pay them. But how Pirate Robertson, right, from Silk Road, how was that guy caught? He was using all of the right stuff. He was doing the Tor, he was doing the end-to-end encryption, and the bad guys are already doing this. It's the common folks that don't have their privacy protected. So that pirate, what's the name like? Sorry? He's Dread Pirate Robertson. That guy was caught up in a regular fashion. There was detectives that looked at the things, and people sleep out on the operational security, as in the regular world. As in the regular world. There was, and there is still, liberties in this world, here in Canada, here in States, here in the Western world. And the fact that the bad guys can use them didn't make this world to collapse. In fact, we, the immigrants, come here because it's better. But the reason it's better, because of this fundamental trust and respect for the lives. And basically, I own my life. I own my body. And there's a respect for me to do the way I feel, right? Instead, like, as long as I'm not hurting somebody, I can do whatever I can. That's my ownership of myself. Now, we need the same ownership in the digital sphere. And we don't privacy right now because we don't have ownership. The ownership is the bigger thing. Time's up. Paul's control the time, but he has a question.
So what happens when the nice little hard drive connected to your 3N server dies?
So, good, very good question. So, these guys doing this little device, the frequently asked question section says, like, what happens if it's stolen? If it's flooded, very common thing in States. So, backups. So, in case if it's stolen, there's nothing on because all the keys never got onto the servers. Keys were always either on your desktop or your mobile device, but never on the server. So the stealing of the server is equivalent to the flood. Now, the flooding, you need to do a backup. So privacy safe guys will provide the privacy sync server, which we're going to write for them, especially tailored for the sort of communication patterns that are in the 3N web server, so that it's more robust than like just regular backup, which is done by Backblaze or by some other companies. So yeah, and it will be a monthly service, and it will be sort of compares the same prices that we will try to charge for the just serving 3N web to people that don't have their own server. And competitive pricing. Shall I say $15 for the 250 gigabytes? And in order for it to be competitive, so it's competitive with Amazon, right? And that's the reason why I cannot use the Amazon cloud, because otherwise I won't make any money. Unfortunately, some of the big players, they are doing the cross-subsidizing. So let's say we will ask for $15 and they may charge $10. But with them, you pay and you lose your privacy. With us, you have all, or you can run the server yourself. You have that freedom. Other questions? We want to go to a restaurant. Time for beer.
Thank you for listening to the Kitchener-Waterloo Linux User Group audio podcast. Our monthly meetings are free of charge and open to all, so please join us if you are around. We meet on the first non-holiday Monday of each month from 7 to 9 p.m. in Kitchener. Please visit kwlug.org for upcoming topics, for directions, and for additional meeting information. In addition to attending a meeting, you can participate in the KWLUG community by joining our email discussion list, by offering to present a topic, or just by spreading the word about this podcast. Thanks also to IndieServe Networks, Archive.org, and CCJ Clearline for hosting our website and multimedia files, to the Working Center for offering meeting space, and to the many people who participate in the KWLUG community. Until next time, goodbye world.